Right on. I was reminded this week, someone sent me an email with a little illustration in it, reminding me of the fact that we as Christians have so much to be thankful for and so much to be excited about that one of the natural reactions to what we have experienced and what we know is to share that. And I remember when I first started dating my wife, Rebecca, before we were married, and you know what it's like, maybe some of you, where you start, you know, not everyone knows you have a girlfriend yet, and so you're trying to, in every conversation, fit in the words, my girlfriend, right? Because you're just excited about that, and something interesting happens in your life, and you're trying to look for, you know, humble ways to brag about it, right? Or you find money in a strange place, and you don't just keep that story to yourself, you go tell somebody about it. Or when I go out and I play some pickup hockey or something, and if I score a goal, I'll come home and tell my wife the whole story, and she pretends to be impressed, right? Because when we have something exciting happen in our life, one of the most natural and normal things to do is to share it, to tell others about it. And additionally, if, say, my story of telling someone how I found some money randomly also enabled them to have the same blessing, then I would almost be morally responsible to tell them the story. And if I was holding it back, I'd actually be keeping them from experience personal joy and fulfillment. And that is the truth for believers, that we have something so good, so amazing, not something that we earned or achieved or gained in our own methods, but something that has been gifted to us and is available to everyone. They just need to hear about it. And so we've been doing this series called Asking for a Friend, because the world is searching. People are asking. People want to know what truth is. They want to know if there is a God in the universe. They want to know what he is like if they are searching for him. And we have been given this great gift of Jesus Christ. And those of us who have met Jesus Christ have a responsibility to share him. But often we feel under-equipped. Often we feel like we can't do it, or we don't have the words to say, or we have a hard time answering the difficult questions. And so this series has been about looking at seven of the toughest questions that we face, and seven of the most common questions that we might face in talking to our friends or neighbors or coworkers, and trying to inform us and equip us so that we can do well in those conversations as we share the gospel and share the good news with people. Our key verse has been in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, which says, "Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect." So we are trying to equip ourselves to have gentle and respectful conversations with people who are interested in why we believe what we believe. So today we're on week 6, and we are addressing the question, hey, aren't all religions the same? There's a lot of different ways that this question has been framed and has been approached differently. A lot of people will say something like, all religions basically teach the same thing. They just have differences around kind of the secondary issues, but all of it's basically the same. Or some people will say, I believe that all religions are just different ways to the same place. They all will lead us to God. They're all just different paths that we all take, but they're all leading to the same destination. Or people will categorize on one side religious people over here, and on the other side there's non-religious people over here, but the religious people are all kind of in the same category. So aren't all religions basically the same thing? Now, we live in a multicultural and pluralistic society in Canada, and more the whole world is becoming multicultural and pluralistic. Maybe Penticton doesn't have quite as much ethnic diversity as, say, Vancouver or Toronto, but even here, there are many different ethnicities represented. There are many different ethnicities represented in our church, and in our community, there are many different religions that are practiced. And so we live in this very multicultural and pluralistic society, and it's actually a wonderful thing that people have the freedom to worship how they want to worship, and we should actually be willing to fight for those rights, even if we disagree with how people want to worship, because if we want to have the freedom to worship how we want to worship, those are rights that we certainly want to fight for everybody. But one of the effects of multiculturalism and pluralism is that they create an environment where people begin to view all religions the same. So we live in a place where we want to treat everyone the same. Everybody has equal rights, no matter who they are or where they came from. Everyone should have equal access to public resources, and so therefore everything everyone believes needs to be treated equally as well. And so it kind of, that's the process of thinking where all beliefs are equally valid, all beliefs are equally true, everyone kind of believes things that are all just going in the same direction. And so Christian, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, Mormon, they're all just religious people who are believing in a god or gods, but it's basically all in one category. Now, you may or may not have heard the parable of the blind man and the elephant. It's an Eastern parable. I believe it came out of India. And I've heard it told many different ways, but here's one of the ways this parable is told. There are four blind men kind of grasping in the dark, walking through this area, and they come upon an elephant. And they each kind of bump into a different part of the elephant. One blind man bumps into the elephant's leg, and he says, an elephant is like a tree. And then another blind man says, no, he bumps into the side of the elephant. He says, no, an elephant is like a wall. And then the other blind man bumps into the ear of the elephant and says, no, an elephant is like a sail. And the fourth blind man bumps into the elephant's trunk and says, no, an elephant is like a snake. And then the teller of the story is trying to get across the point that these blind men are all touching, reaching out in the dark, and they are feeling the same thing, but they're only able to come to the conclusions that their own senses are able to lead them to. And so if one person thinks it's like a tree, a wall, or a snake, or a sail, well, then they are right, but they're all just understanding part of the whole. And the moral of the story is that every religion only understands a part of what is the whole truth. And if we would just understand that, and then we could respect each other and know that they have some of the truth, and we have some of the truth, and they over there have some of the truth, we would all get along much better. And so that's kind of the worldview that we often have in our kind of multicultural society, that we all have a kind of the truth, and every religion is basically talking about the same thing, just in different ways. We're all using different ways of understanding, but we all are just groping blindly in the dark. And we'll come back to that parable in a couple of minutes. But this leads people to often write off religion as unnecessary because in the end, it doesn't really matter what you believe. You just need to live a good life, be kind to people, pay your taxes, unless you can get away with not paying your taxes, and then you'll be fine. You'll be a good person, and that's really all that's necessary in life. Now, first of all, it's a false assumption to assume that just because you don't call yourself a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist or a Muslim, it's a false assumption to assume that therefore you are not religious. In fact, everyone is religious in some way, even if they don't align themselves with a traditional religion. You might ask, how so? Well, look at a few of the ways that that religion can be defined. Certainly, a classic definition is that religion is belief in and worship of a divine being or a system of faith and practice, right? So there's a divine being involved, there's a system, maybe certain actions and attitudes and thought patterns that you adhere to as a believer in a specific religion. That is one way religion is defined. But here's another definition I read recently. It's this: religion is a pursuit or interest to which someone ascribes supreme importance. Everybody ascribes supreme importance to something. And so it's false to say I don't worship anything, that nothing is my object of worship. Something in our lives, if it's not a God, we're going to replace God with something else that has supreme importance in our lives. It's not like some people worship and some people don't. We all worship. It just depends what it is. For some people, God is of supreme importance. For other people, it's a sport. For other people, it's power or money or sex that is of supreme importance in their lives. And so then we begin to do acts of worship to those things. We worship our thing of supreme importance by giving our time and energy and wealth to it. We make sacrifices of other things in order to have more of the thing that is of supreme importance. We say no to certain desires so that we can continue to pursue with all of our might the thing that is of supreme importance. So that might not be God, it might not be a specific religious path, but it is something in our lives that is of supreme importance. So we are all religious in that way. Another way to think about religion is this: religion provides a set of answers to questions that cannot be discovered in a test tube. Right? So there are lots of things that the scientific process or good philosophical thought can lead us to quite firm conclusions on certain things that we would say are true. But there are a lot of things that science and philosophy could never fully touch. They could never fully answer certain questions. And so all of us need to build some sort of framework, some sort of ideology that helps answer those questions. What is the purpose of life? Where do I fit in? What is my ultimate purpose? What is the value of a human life, and when does that life begin? Is there a difference between eating bacon and eating Kevin Bacon, right? Because, and you laugh, but without some sort of divine command, it's actually hard to defend a moral abhorrence to cannibalism. Because if we are just part of a natural order and we are another animal that just can think better than the other ones, there's really no difference between eating another human and a cow other than the fact that we don't like it, right? Whereas if you come from a position of a divine command where God actually creates an order and he says, no, humans are different than animals, then you have a firm belief in why it's different to eat bacon and Kevin Bacon, right? So this is an ideology that we must develop. Everyone is religious in some way as a means to answer questions that cannot be answered in a laboratory. And so all of us in some way have religion. Our answers are reflected in our actions, and those answers are reflected in public policy, and they're reflected in our morality, both personal and corporate. And so we need to come up with those answers, and therefore all of us will have some sort of ideology or religion that undergirds how we live. So all of us will ascribe supreme importance to something or someone. All of us are coming up with these sorts of answers. So whether you accept the whole package of a specific kind of classical religion or whether you've created your own package, each one of us is religious. Now, we live in a world where religion isn't going away. No matter how hard certain groups have tried, no matter how hard an atheistic government or an atheistic regime or certain brands of it have tried to just destroy religion of all kinds, it continues to swell up. Interest in spirituality is higher than it's ever been. So we live in a world where religion is not going away. But the real conflict comes when any particular religion makes a sort of truth claim, a truth claim to an exclusive knowledge of the truth. Where religion says, we know something, or we believe something that is right, and therefore excludes beliefs of other people groups or other religions. This religion over here believes in this, and no, if people don't believe this, they're not saved, or they're not right, or they're just plain wrong, and so it actually begins to exclude people out of that. And so that's when conflict arises, and arguments happen, and people start to get at one another. So the better approach, it is claimed, especially in a multicultural society, is for all of us to agree that every belief is equally valid, that all religions lead to God, that we're all believing the basically same thing. We should stop fighting about it. We should all recognize that we are all blind men grasping in the dark, all just knowing a part of what is the complete truth. And so if you go back to that elephant of ours and that parable of the blind man and the elephant, one of the things to recognize is that this parable is in many ways self-defeating. Because here are these four blind men grasping out for the elephant, and one thinks it's this and that and that, and so the moral of the story is that all of them just know part of the truth. But think about the arrogance of this parable, because somebody is telling this parable. Somebody who can see the elephant is saying that nobody else can see the elephant. Somebody is telling this story and witnessing four blind men reaching in the dark and saying, look, none of them know what I know. I know that there's an elephant. I know that all of them only know part of the truth, and I know the truth. Therefore, no one should be arrogant thinking that they know the truth, except for me. Right? So to say that all religions are the same, to say that all religions lead to the same place, to say that all religions only know part of the truth, is to claim that I know all of the truth. It's actually more arrogant to say all religions are the same than for someone to say their one in particular religion is the same. Because if I'm going to say all religions are the same, I'm claiming the kind of knowledge I believe nobody else has. I'm claiming more wisdom and more knowledge than any person who has ever lived and followed any sort of religion. And I'm saying, no, you guys are all wrong. You should believe me because I know there's actually an elephant in this scene. So as we've seen here, we can't. It sounds humble to say that all religions are the same, but it actually can lead to even greater arrogance than one religion claiming truth, at least equal. Tim Keller says it like this. He says, it is no more narrow to claim that one religion is right than to claim that one way to think about all religions, namely that all are equal, is right. We are all exclusive in our beliefs about religion, but in different ways. Okay, so all of us are coming at this and claiming we have moral authority, claiming we have more truth than somebody else. It's just in different ways. And so let's examine a little bit about what Christianity is saying, and let's examine how Christianity actually opens up the door of inclusivity and does not actually claim things that would actually push people away. So let's look at that. Christianity is one of those faiths that makes exclusive claims. It claims that if Christianity is right, if Jesus is right, then at least other religions are flawed, and at worst, they're completely, totally wrong. We read things in the Bible, like in Acts chapter 4, verse 12, Peter is talking, he says, "Salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to mankind by which we must be saved." So Peter's saying, listen, this is very clear. Jesus has made it very clear to us that there is no other way of salvation other than through him. One of the core beliefs of Christians is that there is no way to experience salvation except through Jesus Christ. Salvation is basically meaning that we are in trouble and we need to somehow get out of it, and Jesus has offered us a way to be saved, and there is only one way. It is not built up by karma or by doing good deeds. It is not by following Buddha or Muhammad. It's not through the Eightfold Path or the Five Pillars, but it is only exclusively through Jesus Christ that salvation can be received. As a result, Christians are often seen as bigoted, prejudiced, narrow-minded, arrogant, thinking that we have the truth and everyone else is wrong. But again, it is no more arrogant to make that claim than to claim that all religions are in some ways wrong and only have part of the truth. But here's the thing, the problem isn't really with Christians. The problem is with this guy Jesus, right? This guy Jesus that Christians really like, and they follow him and they listen to him and they believe his words, and he says some pretty outrageous things. He says some things that if he is wrong, he's pretty arrogant and bigoted and narrow-minded. But if he's right, the consequences are of cosmic proportion. Peter Kreef says it this way: to charge that they are being stubborn or arrogant about their position, Christians reply that it is Jesus' teachings, not theirs, that they are being stubborn about, and that this is not arrogant, for they do not arrogate to themselves the power to change them. Christians simply do not have the authority to do that, because authority means author's rights, and Christians are not the authors, nor even the editors, but only the mail carriers of God's words. What would be arrogant indeed would be to correct Almighty God for the sake of ecumenism. So what he's saying is Christians are just taking the words of Jesus and saying, listen, this is what Jesus said. This is not Christians saying this. And if we wanted to change God's words, that would be the arrogant position. Let's see what Jesus says about himself. One of the classic passages where Jesus gives very exclusive claims about himself is in John chapter 14, verse 1 through 10. Jesus says to his disciples, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." Philip said, "Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Don't you know me, Philip, even after I have been with you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work." So these are Jesus' own words recorded by his close friend John, and Jesus makes at least four incredible claims here. He says, first of all, just like you believe in God, you should believe in me. Secondly, he says, I'm the architect of heaven. I'm building a place for you in heaven. Thirdly, he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to God except through me. And in the original Greek, there's a strong emphasis on I am the way, the truth, the only way, the only truth, and the only life. No one can come to God except through me. And he says, if you've seen me, you've seen God. These are incredibly strong statements. They are bold and they are seemingly arrogant, but they're only arrogant if he's wrong. They're only crazy if he's not telling the truth. But if he is right, then he's being incredibly loving and generous. He's telling us something that can save us. He, being God, set aside his divinity, came down as a human being, humbled himself, and served us by telling us the truth, and then dying on the cross so that we can have access to all the blessings of heaven. If he's right, there are cosmic consequences that need to be understood. If he's wrong, we should just throw him out. We should not be here. We should be doing something different on Sunday mornings. There's no in-between. Jesus doesn't leave room for us to say, good guy, neat person, wonderful teacher. No, he's either who he says he is, or we need to drop him altogether. C.S. Lewis gave his classic lunatic, liar, or Lord comments about this. He says, Jesus is either a lunatic who is absolutely crazy, has no idea what he's talking about, and so we should ignore him completely, or he's a liar, which would make him evil, so we should ignore him completely, or he's right, and therefore he is the Lord of all creation. So we should bow our knees to him in worship and receive him into our lives. So if Jesus is right, he's not being arrogant. He's bringing us good news. If Jesus is right, he's not being exclusive. He's being radically inclusive. He's inviting us into fellowship with heaven when we have done nothing to deserve it. Bruxy Cavey gives this great illustration of Jesus' teachings. He says, this is no more exclusive than if you had fallen into a well and a rescue crew lowered a rope as a way of escape. It would be silly to criticize their one way of escape as too exclusive or restrictive, but people often do this with God. We demand multiple options because we want the power to decide our own method of rescue, because we want to be in charge of everything. We want to play God, but a single solution does not imply exclusivity, not if that solution is offered to everyone without exception. See, Jesus has come to give us a way, and he is that way. And the truth is, we would never be satisfied even if God gave us 1,000 ways. We would want 1,001 because we would want to make our own way. We would want to do it ourselves. In the John 14 passage that we read, Jesus talked about God having a house with many rooms. The implication there is that there's room for everybody. The door is open for everybody to experience the presence of God, to live in heaven eternally with him. But every house has a front door. And the front door of heaven, what's that? It's Jesus. Jesus himself said, I am the door. He is the way that we enter heaven. You and I all have doors on our house or our apartment or wherever we live, and that's generally where we require people to enter if they're coming over. Right? You come in through the front door. I, if I'm coming to your house, have no justification to demand that you let me in through the bathroom window or to let me in through the crawl space or to just cut a hole in your wall because I think that's the best way in. And you, as the owner of the house, have every right, if I am bothering you on your property, to call the police and ask them to take me away as a trespasser. That's what humans are like with God. We are demanding that God run his house the way we think he should. But God has opened a door into a house with room for all of us. That door is Jesus. He has made a way where there was no way before. I'm going to make one final point. The communion team, you can start to go get ready because we're gonna remember Christ's body and blood in a few minutes here. The last point I'll make is this, is that Christianity, though it does make exclusive claims, Jesus, though he does make exclusive claims, provides a basis by which we are radically inclusive. Okay? The teachings and life of Jesus represent a radically inclusive lifestyle where we make room for people in our lives. Think about Jesus himself, who from heaven saw all kinds of people who believed differently than him, who thought differently than him, who acted differently than him, and he wanted to find a way to make room in his life so that they could experience his presence. And so he did not ask us to change first, but he changed for us. He laid aside his divinity. He stepped off his throne. He became a human being. He stepped into our life to show us his love for us. He made room for us, for the people who did not love him, did not know him, did not care about him, believed, acted, and thought differently than him. That leads Christians to do their best to make room in their lives, not asking people to change for us first, but we open doors and make space in our lives even before people are willing to change, because that's what our Master Jesus did first. But think about also a couple of things in the New Testament. The New Testament authors and Jesus himself talk about the fact that non-Christians will recognize Christian behavior as being good, moral, and ethical. Jesus says in Matthew 5:16, "Let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." 1 Peter 2:12 says, "Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." So our behavior should give our Lord a good reputation. Jesus is saying the implications of what you believe are going to turn into actions and lifestyles that when non-believers see you, they will identify your works as good. Not evil, not bigoted, not angry, not judgmental, but good. And so obviously Christians have not always lived up to this. And we have not given our Lord a good reputation through our actions. But Jesus says those who are really following him are going to be seen as doing good in their community. But this poor behavior is a result of a misunderstanding of this second point, or this third point. Christian teaching assumes that people of other faiths and beliefs might actually be more moral and better behaved than we are. Now, why is that? Well, many faiths teach that God accepts people who do good works and gives them rules and laws, and if they follow them, that's the process and path that they can earn acceptance or salvation or good karma or whatever it is. And so there's many faiths where people are wonderful, kind people. You meet a Sikh, you meet a Mormon, you meet all people of all kinds of different faiths, and they're wonderful, kind people, and that's great. But Christianity actually teaches the opposite. Jesus didn't come to teach us how to be good people. He came and taught us that we actually can't do it. We are not good enough. We actually are deeply flawed, deeply burdened, that we are full of sin. And even though we try, we can never even live up to our own standards. So Jesus says, I actually have to come, not to teach you how to be good people, but to die because you are so bad. Right? It's so bad. My sin is so bad that the God of the universe had to take on flesh and die on the cross for me. Yet he loves me so much that he was more than willing to do so. So what that says to me is that I'm going to meet people who don't believe the same things as me, and they're very often going to be lovely, wonderful, even maybe more moral people than I, because I am not a Christian because I'm a wonderful person. I did not earn my salvation. I did not make it into the kingdom because of something I accomplished. I have been given salvation as a free gift, even though I didn't deserve it. So there's no room for arrogance. There's no room for moral superiority. There's no room for judgmentalism, because we didn't earn this. We're not where we are because of what we've done. However, our faith does transform us and give us good deeds and ethics and things to follow, and we do become better people on the outside than when we before we knew Jesus because of what he has done and what he teaches us, but that's not how it starts. We don't become good people, then get saved. We get saved, and then God transforms our life. So I'm going to meet people who don't believe what I believe, and they're going to be much more ethical, wonderful people than I am. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 and 9 says, "It is by grace you have been saved through faith. This is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast." It is by grace you've been saved. Grace is that that free gift of God. It's God looking at our situation, and even though we have earned nothing and deserve nothing from him, he has been generous with us, and we receive that grace by faith in Jesus Christ, by trusting in him. It's not something we have produced, and so there's no way that we can boast about it, because it is all God's work and not ours that has accomplished it.